This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, Summer 2019. This test is in four parts and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1, Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about their professions or jobs. Read the list of professions or jobs below, then listen to the extracts. For questions 1 to 5, identify which profession or job, A to H, is being described by each speaker by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all professions or jobs are described, and each may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Speaker 1.
Every day I'm given the chance to inspire young people and make sure each pupil has the same chance to learn and the opportunity to succeed. I also feel strongly that by trying to be good in my profession, I can give something back to the community and make a strong difference to pupils' lives and learning.
Speaker 2.
My role in an organisation is that of supporting the management. I deal with correspondence, much of which is highly confidential, and organise official events and meetings. My computer and communication skills are very good. Frequently, I am asked to use my initiative. There is more to my profession than just letter writing and photocopying.
Speaker 3.
At first, I worked for a local newspaper, then a national one. Finally, I moved to television. My job is challenging. When I receive a topic or an issue to investigate, I have to research it thoroughly, interview people, and sometimes I am expected to report live from a scene. My ambition is to find a scoop, an exclusive story, and report it.
Speaker 4. I am involved in hospital care. My role is to look after patients, providing basic treatment for them and checking that they are comfortable, especially if they have to stay overnight. I work alongside doctors, giving them information about how the patients are and making sure the patients receive the correct medicine. Speaker 5.
I design everything from family homes to shopping malls. I have to consider not only the appearance of buildings, but also the needs of the people who will be using them. Most of my work is done in an office where I meet clients, draw up plans, and work out the costs. Once a project is underway, I sometimes visit the site to see how work is progressing.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Speaker 1.
Every day I'm given the chance to inspire young people and make sure each pupil has the same chance to learn and the opportunity to succeed. I also feel strongly that by trying to be good in my profession, I can give something back to the community and make a strong difference to pupils' lives and learning.
Speaker 2.
My role in an organisation is that of supporting the management. I deal with correspondence, much of which is highly confidential, and organise official events and meetings. My computer and communication skills are very good. Frequently, I am asked to use my initiative. There is more to my profession than just letter writing and photocopying.
Speaker 3.
At first, I worked for a local newspaper, then a national one. Finally, I moved to television. My job is challenging. When I receive a topic or an issue to investigate, I have to research it thoroughly, interview people, and sometimes I am expected to report live from a scene. My ambition is to find a scoop, an exclusive story, and report it.
Speaker 4. I am involved in hospital care. My role is to look after patients, providing basic treatment for them and checking that they are comfortable, especially if they have to stay overnight. I work alongside doctors, giving them information about how the patients are and making sure the patients receive the correct medicine. Speaker 5.
I design everything from family homes to shopping malls. I have to consider not only the appearance of buildings, but also the needs of the people who will be using them. Most of my work is done in an office where I meet clients, draw up plans, and work out the costs. Once a project is underway, I sometimes visit the site to see how work is progressing.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear a person talking about an unusual tourist attraction. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Deciding what to do with your family over a short school break can be quite difficult. Visiting castles, traditional museums, or art galleries are not always exciting enough, and there is the possibility that you will have bored children on your hands. However, if you want your excited young explorers to have an unusual experience, you could take them to a coal mining museum in the Brecon Beacons National Park in Wales. Not to admire the beautiful countryside, but to go down a real coal mine. Previous visitors have said it was a memorable experience. Standing on the stunning heather-coloured moors at the heart of what was once an industrial landscape, is the Big Pit, a coal mine dug in the early 1860s to provide coal for the local ironworks, for powering steam engines, and for heating thousands of workers' homes. This international award-winning mining museum offers an underground tour in which visitors can take a trip down the 90-metre mine shaft to discover what conditions were like for Welsh miners between the 1860s and 1970s. The mine and its buildings at the Big Pit are a time capsule which shows the development of the mine over 100 years. The buildings have been carefully looked after and maintained so that the life of the pit and the stories of the people who worked there are brought vividly to life. The winding engine and cages are fully operational, and visitors, once they have put on helmets and lamps, are taken on a thrilling ride down the deep mineshaft in these cages. Children will love this, as within a matter of minutes, they are in a completely different world. They are taken on a tour where they learn firsthand from a former coal miner what life was like for the men and boys who worked in the coal mine. To remember your experience in the mine, you can buy some interesting gifts, some made of coal.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Deciding what to do with your family over a short school break can be quite difficult. Visiting castles, traditional museums, or art galleries are not always exciting enough, and there is the possibility that you will have bored children on your hands. However, if you want your excited young explorers to have an unusual experience, you could take them to a coal mining museum in the Brecon Beacons National Park in Wales. Not to admire the beautiful countryside, but to go down a real coal mine. Previous visitors have said it was a memorable experience. Standing on the stunning heather-coloured moors at the heart of what was once an industrial landscape is the Big Pit, a coal mine dug in the early 1860s to provide coal for the local ironworks, for powering steam engines, and for heating thousands of workers' homes. This international award-winning mining museum offers an underground tour in which visitors can take a trip down the 90-metre mine shaft to discover what conditions were like for Welsh miners between the 1860s and 1970s. The mine and its buildings at the Big Pit are a time capsule which shows the development of the mine over 100 years. The buildings have been carefully looked after and maintained so that the life of the pit and the stories of the people who worked there are brought vividly to life. The winding engine and cages are fully operational, and visitors, once they have put on helmets and lamps, are taken on a thrilling ride down the deep mineshaft in these cages. Children will love this, as within a matter of minutes, they are in a completely different world. They are taken on a tour where they learn firsthand from a former coal miner what life was like for the men and boys who worked in the coal mine. To remember your experience in the mine, you can buy some interesting gifts. Some made of coal.
That's the end of Part 1, Section B. Now turn to Part 2. Part 2. In this part, you will hear a person giving advice on how to be a successful blogger. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
The word blog has become so familiar since it emerged towards the end of the 20th century that many do not realise that it comes from the contraction of two words, web and log. A blog is a series of posts on a website arranged in reverse chronological order. The most recent entry is displayed first, and you scroll down to find the earlier ones. Most blogs are personal comments or opinions, and enable readers to respond to them. That way, a conversation develops not only between the reader and the blogger, but also between the readers themselves. In this sense, blogging is a unique form of communication for the computer age. Writing a blog allows anyone who has access to a computer to have a voice, which can potentially reach almost everyone in the world. Blogs cover many different topics and are written in different styles. So, if you decide to write a blog, you should choose a style which suits you best. Many blogs are written by journalists reporting on a situation or story and updating it regularly. Others are more like comment pieces or columns. If you refer to anything factual, always check your sources. You may like to include links and references. Diaries and autobiographies are an obvious way of blogging, but you will need something more than just a "something interesting happened to me yesterday" type of entry to keep readers hooked. You may be telling the story of your struggle to become a world-class athlete, or your search for the ideal job, or telling your family history, or looking in detail at your hometown. As long as you offer a narrative thread, readers will come back for more. Some journals or diaries can be very amusing. If people get a good laugh, they are more likely to return. Some people even write fiction blogs, delivering regular installments of their novels, often ending the latest chapter with a dramatic and exciting moment to encourage readers to come back for more. Other bloggers post short stories or sketches. If this is what you like to do, remember that you shouldn't make your entries too long. Short fiction works well in blog format. Remember, a blog can be a dangerous tool. Your current employer, a teacher at school, your mother, brother, sister, friend, or even someone you have fallen out with, all have access to it. To save yourself and others embarrassment, there is some information that you should avoid posting. Remember, there are work or school-related items that are confidential and should not be shared. Unfortunately, some people have got into trouble because of the content of their blogs. Don't give out personal information about other people. If you do describe something personal, avoid using names or make some up. Also, be wary of posting too much information about yourself. Don't give out personal information such as your full name, where you live, or what school you go to. Be prepared to receive some negative comments or emails if you're blogging on controversial issues you feel strongly about. Always back your commentary with reliable and varied sources so that you can support your beliefs. Most blog audiences are small, but with time and regular updates, these will grow. Bloggers may never have more than a few hundred readers, but people who return regularly are genuinely interested in what you have to say. And finally, start your blog with an About Me page. Your blog reveals personal views and a little bit of you, so introduce yourself briefly to your readers and don't blog anonymously. Make up a blog name for yourself, as readers prefer to interact with a named person.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
The word blog has become so familiar since it emerged towards the end of the 20th century that many do not realise that it comes from the contraction of two words, web and log. A blog is a series of posts on a website arranged in reverse chronological order. The most recent entry is displayed first, and you scroll down to find the earlier ones. Most blogs are personal comments or opinions, and enable readers to respond to them. That way, a conversation develops not only between the reader and the blogger, but also between the readers themselves. In this sense, blogging is a unique form of communication for the computer age. Writing a blog allows anyone who has access to a computer to have a voice, which can potentially reach almost everyone in the world. Blogs cover many different topics and are written in different styles. So, if you decide to write a blog, you should choose a style which suits you best. Many blogs are written by journalists reporting on a situation or story and updating it regularly. Others are more like comment pieces or columns. If you refer to anything factual, always check your sources. You may like to include links and references. Diaries and autobiographies are an obvious way of blogging, but you will need something more than just a "something interesting happened to me yesterday" type of entry to keep readers hooked. You may be telling the story of your struggle to become a world-class athlete, or your search for the ideal job, or telling your family history, or looking in detail at your hometown. As long as you offer a narrative thread, readers will come back for more. Some journals or diaries can be very amusing. If people get a good laugh, they are more likely to return. Some people even write fiction blogs, delivering regular installments of their novels, often ending the latest chapter with a dramatic and exciting moment to encourage readers to come back for more. Other bloggers post short stories or sketches. If this is what you like to do, remember that you shouldn't make your entries too long. Short fiction works well in blog format. Remember, a blog can be a dangerous tool. Your current employer, a teacher at school, your mother, brother, sister, friend, or even someone you have fallen out with, all have access to it. To save yourself and others embarrassment, there is some information that you should avoid posting. Remember, there are work or school-related items that are confidential and should not be shared. Unfortunately, some people have got into trouble because of the content of their blogs. Don't give out personal information about other people. If you do describe something personal, avoid using names or make some up. Also, be wary of posting too much information about yourself. Don't give out personal information such as your full name, where you live, or what school you go to. Be prepared to receive some negative comments or emails if you're blogging on controversial issues you feel strongly about. Always back your commentary with reliable and varied sources so that you can support your beliefs. Most blog audiences are small, but with time and regular updates, these will grow. Bloggers may never have more than a few hundred readers, but people who return regularly are genuinely interested in what you have to say. And finally, start your blog with an About Me page. Your blog reveals personal views and a little bit of you, so introduce yourself briefly to your readers and don't blog anonymously. Make up a blog name for yourself, as readers prefer to interact with a named person.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an interview with a cross-channel swimmer. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Most of us are quite happy to swim in a pool, clocking up the lengths, but not my guest today, whose most amazing achievement must have been last year. At 59, she became the oldest woman to swim the Channel non-stop from Dover to Calais and back in 36 hours and 25 minutes. Cross-channel swimmer Sally Minty Gravett learned to swim in the sea around Jersey, where she lives. In this interview, she describes her unique relationship with the waters surrounding this beautiful island. Sally, you're fortunate to live on an island where you are never more than 10 minutes from the sea. As a cross-channel swimmer, how does that make you feel?
I feel I have a very close relationship with the sea, whether I am swimming in it or walking nearby, with the ocean breeze in my face. There isn't a day that passes when I don't look at it and feel lucky to live somewhere so special. If I do not swim in the sea at least every other day, I am missing something very important.
I gather you started swimming when you were very young. Did you learn to swim on the island?
I moved to Jersey with my parents when I was 3. Back then, there were no public swimming pools, so the sea was the pool where I learned to swim.
That is a rather challenging start for a three-year-old. How has that influenced the way you think of the sea? Weren't you ever afraid?
I think that's when my love affair with the sea began. I try to swim every day in all weather conditions. And I'm sure this has a great deal to do with the fact that I have swum the channel 7 times. The varying sea conditions around the island have been the best preparation for these challenges that I could have ever hoped for. For example, I practice for my last and most recent long-distance swim by swimming twice round the island for each trial session. The distance round the island is 66 miles.
That is really amazing. What concerns me, though, is that the Channel Islands are in one of the busiest waterways for shipping in the world. Surely swimming near the coast of Jersey carries the risk of pollution.
The tides here are quite remarkable. They rise among the highest in the world, which is why the water and the coastline are so free of debris. Each day, incredible waves wash everything clean. Being in the water somehow washes away any troubles or heaviness I might be carrying with me. Within moments of diving into the water, I feel great. That's why I call it my vitamin C. I'm certain that sea swimming is a form of physical and mental therapy, which is far more effective than swimming in a pool.
From looking at pictures of Jersey, I think that my favourite season for swimming would be the height of summer. I can safely presume that this would be your favourite time as well. Or am I wrong? Don't tell me you actually enjoy swimming in the winter.
Well, in summer, the sun sparkles on the water surface in a magical way, and it's absolutely mesmerising. In winter, I love to swim under a full moon. Believe me, there is nothing quite as exhilarating as getting out of the sea on a cold evening, with every inch of me tingling. It's winter swimming for me.
I know from past experience, when I've come to Jersey with my family for a holiday, that there are so many wonderful places to swim, and they all seem to have a personality of their own. So it's quite hard to choose your favourite beach.
You're quite right. In the southern parts of the island, you will find shallow waters and golden sands. Along the north and eastern sides are some beautiful pebble beaches, while the Atlantic waves off the west coast are a sight to behold.
Many of the beaches in Jersey are voted year in and year out as the United Kingdom's favourite beaches and have been awarded the coveted blue flag for cleanliness and outstanding beauty. Jersey is a popular holiday destination not only among the British. It's clear that visitors and local people alike love the sea that surrounds this beautiful island.
Definitely. I'm very privileged, not only to live on this island, but to make my living as a local swimming coach working with future generations of Jersey swimmers. I try to encourage others to embrace the water and to have the confidence to swim out into it. It is my way of giving back to the sea what it has given me, a purpose and a challenge.
I am so impressed with what you have done for the sport. You've not only been a successful marathon swimmer yourself, but have trained many who now follow in your footsteps. And recently, you have been honoured by the Queen for your services to sport and swimming in particular. What did it feel like meeting Her Majesty?
It was a thrilling moment to meet the Queen. But I think the greatest satisfaction I get is from teaching children who do not have the chances in life that I was given, and yet who want to succeed.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Most of us are quite happy to swim in a pool, clocking up the lengths, but not my guest today, whose most amazing achievement must have been last year. At 59, she became the oldest woman to swim the Channel non-stop from Dover to Calais and back in 36 hours and 25 minutes. Cross-channel swimmer Sally Minty Gravett learned to swim in the sea around Jersey where she lives. In this interview, she describes her unique relationship with the waters surrounding this beautiful island. Sally, you're fortunate to live on an island where you are never more than 10 minutes from the sea. As a cross-channel swimmer, how does that make you feel?
I feel I have a very close relationship with the sea, whether I am swimming in it or walking nearby with the ocean breeze in my face. There isn't a day that passes when I don't look at it and feel lucky to live somewhere so special. If I do not swim in the sea at least every other day, I am missing something very important.
I gather you started swimming when you were very young. Did you learn to swim on the island?
I moved to Jersey with my parents when I was 3. Back then, there were no public swimming pools, so the sea was the pool where I learned to swim.
That is a rather challenging start for a 3-year-old. How has that influenced the way you think of the sea? Weren't you ever afraid?
I think that's when my love affair with the sea began. I try to swim every day in all weather conditions. And I'm sure this has a great deal to do with the fact that I have swum the channel 7 times. The varying sea conditions around the island have been the best preparation for these challenges that I could have ever hoped for. For example, I practice for my last and most recent long-distance swim by swimming twice round the island for each trial session. The distance round the island is 66 miles.
That is really amazing. What concerns me, though, is that the Channel Islands are in one of the busiest waterways for shipping in the world. Surely swimming near the coast of Jersey carries the risk of pollution.
The tides here are quite remarkable. They rise among the highest in the world, which is why the water and the coastline are so free of debris. Each day, incredible waves wash everything clean. Being in the water somehow washes away any troubles or heaviness I might be carrying with me. Within moments of diving into the water, I feel great. That's why I call it my vitamin C. I'm certain that sea swimming is a form of physical and mental therapy, which is far more effective than swimming in a pool.
From looking at pictures of Jersey, I think that my favourite season for swimming would be the height of summer. I can safely presume that this would be your favourite time as well. Or am I wrong? Don't tell me you actually enjoy swimming in the winter.
Well, in summer, the sun sparkles on the water surface in a magical way, and it's absolutely mesmerising. In winter, I love to swim under a full moon. Believe me, there is nothing quite as exhilarating as getting out of the sea on a cold evening, with every inch of me tingling. It's winter swimming for me.
I know from past experience, when I've come to Jersey with my family for a holiday, that there are so many wonderful places to swim and they all seem to have a personality of their own, so it's quite hard to choose your favourite beach.
You're quite right. In the southern parts of the island, you will find shallow waters and golden sands. Along the north and eastern sides are some beautiful pebble beaches, while the Atlantic waves off the west coast are a sight to behold.
Many of the beaches in Jersey are voted year in and year out as the United Kingdom's favourite beaches and have been awarded the coveted blue flag for cleanliness and outstanding beauty. Jersey is a popular holiday destination not only among the British. It's clear that visitors and local people alike love the sea that surrounds this beautiful island.
Definitely. I'm very privileged, not only to live on this island, but to make my living as a local swimming coach working with future generations of Jersey swimmers. I try to encourage others to embrace the water and to have the confidence to swim out into it. It is my way of giving back to the sea what it has given me, a purpose and a challenge.
I'm so impressed with what you have done for the sport. You've not only been a successful marathon swimmer yourself, but have trained many who now follow in your footsteps. And recently, you have been honoured by the Queen for your services to sport and swimming in particular. What did it feel like meeting Her Majesty?
It was a thrilling moment to meet the Queen. But I think the greatest satisfaction I get is from teaching children who do not have the chances in life that I was given, and yet who want to succeed.
That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four. In this part, you will hear an extract from a recording in which an astronaut is answering questions about space travel. For questions 31 to 32 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than three words for each answer. For questions 33 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Welcome to Tim Peake, who is a European Space Agency astronaut. In June 2016, he completed a 186-day mission working on the International Space Station. He is here to answer some questions about his amazing and unique experience.
Thank you. Just as the Apollo missions in the 1960s took a giant leap for mankind, we are now at the start of a new golden age of space exploration. In the coming decades, we can expect to colonize the Moon, to set foot on Mars, and to travel deeper into our solar system than ever before. Since I returned from the International Space Station, I have been amazed by some of the intriguing and searching questions asked by people on every aspect of my mission.
One of the most commonly asked questions we have received for you must be, how did going up into space affect your sense of time?
Common questions, but very important. The human body has a natural perception of time. This is called the circadian rhythm. It not only dictates when we feel tired and alert, but has an effect on how our body works. For example, our body temperature, our levels of concentration, and how quickly we can learn new things. The most common way to confuse this rhythm is to experience a large and rapid shift in time zone, known as jet lag. Astronauts undergo a 4-week period of training to minimize the effects of jet lag. Our body rhythm is very sensitive to light in order to regulate our perception of time. One of the main challenges in adopting good sleeping patterns in space is to get used to the frequent day and night cycle caused by orbiting the Earth 16 times in 24 hours. Once aboard the craft, astronauts keep to a strict routine of mealtimes, rest, and exercise, which are set to Greenwich Mean Time. At first, it felt strange having a coffee break when it was pitch black outside and the craft was over China, or I am getting ready to go to bed and it could be midday over Europe. I discovered that the worst thing I could do prior to bedtime was to look out of the window during daylight. The burst of ultraviolet light I got from the sun stopped my body producing the hormone which made me feel sleepy. This upset my natural sleep patterns and stopped me sleeping for hours. With regular exercise and sleep patterns, the crew, including me, quickly became unaffected by the 16-orbit day and night cycle.
Another popular question was on exercise. How do you keep fit in space?
Keeping fit in space is really important, not simply to be able to function effectively in weightlessness, but in order to cope with gravity once the mission is over and you are back on Earth. The human body is extremely good at adapting to a new environment. Left to its own devices, the body would morph into the perfect being for living in space. This would make the return to Earth, with its gravity, particularly punishing. To that end, the exercises astronauts do in space focus on trying to decrease as much as possible the negative aspects caused by microgravity. Lack of gravity causes a reduction in muscle mass and strength, bone density, and cardiovascular fitness. Astronauts use a weight training device, which is like a multi-gym, a specially adapted treadmill and a bicycle machine. This equipment allows us to stimulate all the major muscle groups using a number of different exercises. The multi-gym is particularly good for the prime mover muscles, such as biceps, triceps, and pectorals. The treadmill and bicycle machine help maintain cardiovascular fitness and prevent the heart muscle from deteriorating.
One last question. What are the benefits of research done in space?
When Yuri Gagarin launched into space in 1961, flight surgeons were concerned that the human body would not tolerate weightlessness. Since then, humans have not only tolerated weightlessness, but also have managed to adapt and excel in this new environment for extended periods of time. Along the way, a vast amount of scientific information has been learnt, not only about the human body, but in almost every field of scientific research. The space environment has been particularly helpful in creating new strains of vaccines to fight illnesses. Scientists have been able to use microgravity to test the effectiveness and strength of vaccines and select the most suitable for use on Earth. Rapid changes that occur to the human body as it adapts to weightlessness can provide a unique model to study what happens to our bodies as we get older. New forms of metal which have been created in a weightless environment have been successfully tested on Earth. Lighter machinery, such as cars or planes, constructed from these metals, could lead to reduced fuel consumption and lower exhaust emissions. It is not only government-funded research that is being conducted. More and more commercial companies are realizing the benefits of space-based research as the International Space Station grows as a basis for innovation both within the public and private sectors.
The next step?
We have entered an era of international cooperation, exciting opportunities for collaboration and new partnerships. It is no longer a question of if we colonize Mars or the Moon, but when.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Welcome to Tim Peake, who is a European Space Agency astronaut. In June 2016, he completed a 186-day mission working on the International Space Station. He is here to answer some questions about his amazing and unique experience.
Thank you. Just as the Apollo missions in the 1960s took a giant leap for mankind, we are now at the start of a new golden age of space exploration. In the coming decades, we can expect to colonize the Moon, to set foot on Mars, and to travel deeper into our solar system than ever before. Since I returned from the International Space Station, I have been amazed by some of the intriguing and searching questions asked by people on every aspect of my mission.
One of the most commonly asked questions we have received for you must be, how did going up into space affect your sense of time?
Common questions, but very important. The human body has a natural perception of time. This is called the circadian rhythm. It not only dictates when we feel tired and alert, but has an effect on how our body works. For example, our body temperature, our levels of concentration, and how quickly we can learn new things. The most common way to confuse this rhythm is to experience a large and rapid shift in time zone, known as jet lag. Astronauts undergo a 4-week period of training to minimize the effects of jet lag. Our body rhythm is very sensitive to light in order to regulate our perception of time. One of the main challenges in adopting good sleeping patterns in space is to get used to the frequent day and night cycle caused by orbiting the Earth 16 times in 24 hours. Once aboard the craft, astronauts keep to a strict routine of mealtimes, rest and exercise, which are set to Greenwich Mean Time. At first, it felt strange having a coffee break when it was pitch black outside and the craft was over China, or I am getting ready to go to bed and it could be midday over Europe. I discovered that the worst thing I could do prior to bedtime was to look out of the window during daylight. The burst of ultraviolet light I got from the sun stopped my body producing the hormone which made me feel sleepy. This upset my natural sleep patterns and stopped me sleeping for hours. With regular exercise and sleep patterns, the crew, including me, quickly became unaffected by the 16-orbit day and night cycle.
Another popular question was on exercise. How do you keep fit in space?
Keeping fit in space is really important, not simply to be able to function effectively in weightlessness, but in order to cope with gravity once the mission is over and you are back on Earth. The human body is extremely good at adapting to a new environment. Left to its own devices, the body would morph into the perfect being for living in space. This would make the return to Earth with its gravity particularly punishing. To that end, the exercises astronauts do in space focus on trying to decrease as much as possible the negative aspects caused by microgravity. Lack of gravity causes a reduction in muscle mass and strength, bone density, and cardiovascular fitness. Astronauts use a weight training device which is like a multi-gym, a specially adapted treadmill and a bicycle machine. This equipment allows us to stimulate all the major muscle groups using a number of different exercises. The multi-gym is particularly good for the prime mover muscles, such as biceps, triceps, and pectorals. The treadmill and bicycle machine help maintain cardiovascular fitness and prevent the heart muscle from deteriorating.
One last question. What are the benefits of research done in space?
When Yuri Gagarin launched into space in 1961, flight surgeons were concerned that the human body would not tolerate weightlessness. Since then, humans have not only tolerated weightlessness, but also have managed to adapt and excel in this new environment for extended periods of time. Along the way, a vast amount of scientific information has been learnt, not only about the human body, but in almost every field of scientific research. The space environment has been particularly helpful in creating new strains of vaccines to fight illnesses. Scientists have been able to use microgravity to test the effectiveness and strength of vaccines and select the most suitable for use on Earth. Rapid changes that occur to the human body as it adapts to weightlessness can provide a unique model to study what happens to our bodies as we get older. New forms of metal which have been created in a weightless environment have been successfully tested on Earth. Lighter machinery, such as cars or planes, constructed from these metals, could lead to reduced fuel consumption and lower exhaust emissions. It is not only government-funded research that is being conducted. More and more commercial companies are realizing the benefits of space-based research as the International Space Station grows as a basis for innovation both within the public and private sectors.
The next step?
We have entered an era of international cooperation, exciting opportunities for collaboration and new partnerships. It is no longer a question of if we colonize Mars or the Moon, but when.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you and good luck.